welcome to episode 54 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. Can't we all just get along? Round two! You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of Bud and Lou, but of many, many others. You're moving into a land of both comedic films and TV. You've just crossed over into the Nick Santamaria zone.
And when I'm drinking, it's a loading zone. You know, as you do these introductions, my mind is going, okay, what am I going to answer with? What am I going to answer with? What am I going to say? Do I have a funny joke? Do I have blah, 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 blah. That one just split second. Just came out. I'm sorry. I gave birth to it very quickly. That's why I have such a good delivery. But you know, it's
the yes
today with their long hair and their Elvis dancing. Okay, this is episode number 54. I can't believe it.
Yep.
You know, this is like that winner 54. We have basically, I want to begin right away because we have some emails from some people who actually paid attention to my request. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people sent us emails, and they all deserve to be heard. So I'm going to read some of them before we get to our big parade of of obscure comedians. We're going to do this one, and it's Dear Nick Santamaria. Boy, that's pretty formal. This is from Jackie Adamson. Hiya, neighbor. That's the good, hiya, neighbor. Thank you and Jerry for keeping the legacy of Abbott and Costello alive through your podcasts. As your Abbott and Costello podcasts are very enlightening, especially during these dark times. Now, my favorite Abbott and Costello podcasts are the ones that see the boys in a different light, such as We Need Our Own Bud and Lou, Two Fives for a Ten, and Can't We All Just Get Along? So I see what she likes. So in the spirit of shining a new light on Abbott and Costello, here are my podcast ideas. Number one, Abbott and Costello Meet the Three Stooges, with Bud and Moe's similarity, the Lou and Curly controversy, the Shemp and Joe connection, the Bud and Lou versus Moe, Larry, and Curly Joe film comparisons. And that's all very interesting. In fact, I wrote down, after reading this email, I wrote down the Three Stooges as part of my list today to discuss. So thank you for that. Number two, Wheeler and Who? In the 1930s, Wheeler and Woolsey were the most popular comedy team. No, actually, Laurel and Hardy were. Wheeler and Woolsey were a distant second. And I mean distant. They didn't make nearly as much money as Laurel and Hardy's films. In the 1940s, Abbott and Costello became the most popular comedy team of all time, true, while Wheeler and Woolsey were forgotten. But why? We're going to be discussing that today, too. So you're really ahead of the game here, Jackie. And number three, reading is fundamental. A look at Abbott and Costello books, from Who's On First by Richard J. Annobile in 1974, to The Annotated Abbott and Costello by Matthew Conium and Nick Santamaria in 2023, along with other Abbott and Costello books published before, after, and in between. Yeah, so we could discuss that. That'd be good, actually, for an episode. Again, thank you and Jerry for your Abbott and Costello podcasts. If you could read my email on your podcast, great. I would be appreciative. Sincerely, Jackie Lynn. Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you.
That was excellent. You made excellent suggestions there, Jer, huh?
Yeah, very good. We could do half a dozen more episodes just off that one email.
Actually, that's quite true. And just so our listeners know, I'm having more and more trouble coming up with Abbott and Costello themed topics. In fact, we're going to discuss this later on. I think we're going to start stretching out, going beyond Abbott and Costello, which we've already kind of done, but you know, I just think it'd be a great idea because I'm starting to panic. Okay. This guy has the best name ever. His name is Benjamin Wink. Yep. Like Wink soda. Remember Wink?
Wink oh, was gosh, like a, yes.
Yeah, it was almost like a tonic water. Uh-huh. Wink. It was terrible. Okay, but Ben is nice. Hello. First off, let me just say that I was never a fan of Abbott and Costello while I was growing up. Seems a harsh thing to say, but please bear with me. I always threw the boys to the side as being B or C tier at best. However, that changed when I took a flyer on your and Matthew Conium's book. Being a fan of Matthew's other books and of your comedy work and historical perspectives you give on the episodes of Marx Brothers Council podcast that you guested on, I could give Bud and Lou a whirl. After all, these were two voices I respected when it came to comedy. And I heartily enjoyed the book. So I hunted down all of Bud and Lou's films, bought them all along the way, and watched them in order while following along with the timestamps in the respective chapters of your book. It gave terrific perspective, and I became a fan of the boys, kicking myself for being so obstinate on them in the first place. So thank you, sir. And so when back in the day you mentioned that you were starting a Bud and Lou podcast with Jerry, I jumped on right away, and aside from you guys not sharing more material from the Bud Abbott vaults, I love the podcast. Aside from Meets Frankenstein, keep in mind that I'd never seen any of these films before. I'm pushing 50 years old, and I'm as newbie as it gets. But now, Bud and Lou are a welcome addition to my shelves that are already stacked with Marx Brothers, W.C. Fields, Chaplin, Keaton, Lloyd, Stan and Ollie, Bert and Bob, Moe, Larry, Curly and Shemp, Roscoe Arbuckle, Harry Langdon, Charlie Chase, and so many others from the first 40 years of film comedy. Among my favorites are The Noose Hangs High, Abbott and Costello Meet Captain Kidd, that's one of my favorites too, Pardon My Sarong, also one of my favorites, Wistful Widow of Wagon Gap, also one of my favorites, Time of Their Lives, blah, 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 and of course, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. All great choices, by the way. A question I have is, aside from the marvelous annotated Abbott and Costello, what are the best books on the boys? I have the Jim Mulholland book, as well as Bud and Lou. I thought Mulholland was pretty fair toward the boys, and it was a nice read. He's right. It was an excellent book. Meanwhile, Bud and Lou was a train wreck that I had to read. But besides those books existing, which others would you recommend? Or perhaps that's a good Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast future episode topic. Anyway, thanks for your time, and much thanks to you and Jerry for this great podcast. Thanks again, and I hope you and your mom are well. We are. Thank you for saying that. Take care, and all the best. Ben Wink. Thank you, Ben. I think the book idea is nice. A good idea for an episode. Don't you think, Jerry, or would you? Should we just throw it in now?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think?
We could throw it in right now. Yeah, now is a good time.
Okay. I'm going to say, Ben, if you're going to be looking at books, the Mulholland book is tough to top. It's really the most simple of the books and the thinnest of the books, but it really covers everything. It really covers all their films, covers the TV show, covers all of that. It's just not as thorough, let's say, as the annotated Abbott and Costello. There's also a book about their war years. I think it's Scott Allen Nolan wrote it, but it's Abbott and Costello during the war years. That's all you'd have to put into search engine. It'll come up. There's also one by Jeffrey Miller, The Horror Spoofs of Abbott and Costello, it's called. And to tell you the truth, I could barely get through it. It was just really badly done. So I don't recommend that one. Then there's the one that a lot of people consider to be a great Abbott and Costello book. I'm going to mention it, even though these people are very, very petty and not very nice to us. Abbott and Costello in Hollywood is actually quite a good book. But the definitive book came out a couple of years ago, and that's the annotated Abbott and Costello. And to be honest with you, Ben, it's the only book you'll need. That's it. Even John Landis says it in the foreword. There's almost too much information. So there you go. Those are the books. Okay. Next up, we have an email from Peter Freeman. And he says, Nick and Jerry, as I'm working my way through the movies once again, I'm noticing that Walter Schumann's music is incredible. It is complex, perfectly synced to the action of the films, and always manages to enhance whatever emotion is being communicated. While the songs in the movies are uneven, Schumann's music is consistently top-notch. Hope all is well, your friend, Pete. Well, Pete, doing my research, it's interesting because Walter's music is all stuff he did for the Universal Library. So it's all stock music. It's not like they call Walter, we want him to write something for this movie. No, it's already it was already written. They just applied it wherever it was necessary. So Walter did a great job, and the music is terrific. But to be honest, I'll take Frank Skinner any day. He's the one who did all the horror movies. He did Abbott and Bellamy, Frankenstein. Great, great music. And they just released it on CD. The music to Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, and then a follow-up, the Abbott and Costello Meet Keystone Cops, which is just rousing, you know? It's so much fun. So there you go. There's Walter. Walter was a stock guy. He wrote the stock music. Next we have Janet Carlson. Hi, Nick and Jerry. I would like to see you do a podcast or two on the Ritz brothers, and one or two, and maybe more, on the Bowery Boys. Thank you, Janet. Janet, I've already thought about that. Number one, I love the Bowery Boys, and I could talk about them for weeks. Their history, the movies, everything. And the Ritz brothers, too. The Ritz brothers, actually, Harry was a buddy of mine. So I would love to talk about the Ritz brothers. I just love them. So that's a great idea, and that's something we're going to be doing today, because I have them on my list. So you'll be hearing about them today, and we might just go at one point do their Universal movies. They did four for Universal, and we could go over those. I can send Jerry the links, and you'll have a good time. I don't think any of them are over an hour. You know, not a big, time waster. So there you go. Thank you. Thank you, Janet. We appreciate that. And yeah, you're going to get your wish today. Okay. James Shailene. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Did they call you Kid Shailene when you were a kid? That was Lee Marvin's name in Cat Ballou. Kid Shailene.
Yes.
Anyway. Anyone else? Yes. Okay. So Mr. Shailene, or Shailene, or Shalala. I'm curious if you or Jerry know how popular their 8mm Castle films were in the 1970s, in the pre-home video days. I bought a bunch, and when I got a sound projector, I got more. My first was Money Muddlers, containing several well-known routines. Yes, Jerry, did you have the Castle films?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Me too. I would say probably the first one that I bought with the silent projector was Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And then when I got my first sound projector, it was Knights of the Bath from In Society.
That's right.
But yeah, I still have them. I still have the projector. I still have the films. Every now and again, I impress people by pulling them out and watching real movies in our living room.
Wow. I just love the fact that at that time, we were thrilled to have 6 minutes of a feature film. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Running through our projectors. It's amazing. But I had a whole collection. I had a big box full of them. I recently gave them to my doctor. My doctor was a big fan of Castle films. And I just said, you know what? You could have them. I don't have a projector anymore. You know, what's the point, really? Mm-hmm. So I gave them to him. But yeah, those were very, very popular. What I was going to say was, in my neighborhood on Long Island, you couldn't go to a department store that didn't have a glass case filled with these movies, Castle films. And they were all, you know, they were, Abbott and Costello were probably the most popular of the films. But then there were the horror movies. You know, you had House of Frankenstein. I had that one. House of Dracula. I had some of the Mummy movies. You know, the Universal really put all this stuff out there. But again, Abbott and Costello made out like bandits. when these movies were released. Universal tried to do them secretly without telling the boys. And their manager, Eddie Sherman, was walking down the street, saw them in the window, and $3 million later, so there you go. So yeah, they were very, very popular during the day. So yeah, and look at you. You bought a bunch of them too, Jim. There you go. So moving on. John Hayes. You had a two-parter here, and I wrote back. Okay, he wrote, tell me about Bud when he jumped the shark. And I wrote back and said, I'm not sure what you mean by this. I know what jumping the shark is, but how is it applied to Bud?
Certainly. Get that shark away from me. Get out of here.
Oh, you just broke its jaws. He wrote back, when he was no longer sharp and became crabby and paunchy, which are two of my favorite dwarves.
Okay.
From Snow White. Crabby and paunchy. Yeah, Bud started losing it, I think, in the early 50s. He just slowed down. He did less stuff. Lou was pretty much carrying the ball on the Colgate shows. And there was a lot more of, I'm going over here. You get a job and I'll be over here doing this stuff. You know, and they would split up and Lou would do 10 minutes and Bud would come in and do 5 minutes with Lou and then go away again. So he, again, I stress this, but the 9-year difference made a difference. It, you know, he was older. Mm-hmm. And you get to a point where, let's say the mid-50s, where he was 60 years old, 61 years old, he didn't age well. You know, when you smoke 100,000 cigarettes a day, you know, and you're drinking every night, you're not going to age well. And he didn't. He really didn't.
Yeah.
So it affected his performances. And, you know, you can't blame Lou for wanting to move on. You know, they did everything they could do. They were as successful as they were going to get. Now it was only down from there. So why do it? Mm. Why, you know? So Bud, you know, when he tried to team with Candy Candido in the early 60s, there's a hint of desperation there. You know, I know he needed the money. It seemed like a very good thing. And for a while it was, from what I understand. And then his health just gave out. He was not a healthy guy. And that was the reason he slowed down. And all of those reasons I mentioned, cigarettes, drinking, late nights where he couldn't sleep. And he had epilepsy, the poor man, you know? So anyway, that was Bud's story. And when you see him in like Dance With Me, Henry, he's like slurring, you know, he's wonderful in the sense that I could see him as a supporting player in Lou's sitcom. You know what I mean? Because Lou is still going on all seasons. But Bud, you know, he got old. He got old pretty quickly. We love him, but he got old pretty quickly. So I hope that answers your question. John, crabby and paunchy. I love that. Paunchy sounds like something they'd name Harpo in an MGM.
Hey, Paunchy. Yeah, you got to ask Paunchy.
All right. And here is my friend, Alan Hodge. I love his name, H-O-D-G-E. I believe he's in England. I could be wrong. Let me know, Alan, if I'm wrong. So he says, by your request for listener input for the next ANC Meet the Podcast, every time I watch Jack and the Beanstalk, the thought crosses my mind that if Bud and Lou had resolved their various health and personal issues and continued making feature films as a team, they could have gone the Stooges route of playing to a more juvenile audience. The world of fairy tales, legends, and myths would have provided a wealth of great public domain material that would have been a perfect fit for the boys. Bud and Lou as ersatz Aladdins up against bad guy lamp stealer John Carradine with Joe Besser as a permanently irritated genie. Isn't that a great idea? Or as Alibaba replacements at the mercy of the 40 thieves led by someone like Sheldon Leonard or Timothy Carey. And of course, The 40 thieves are over there. And of course, lots of opportunities for leading ladies like Hilary Brooke as various unobtainable princesses. Any views? I love it. Are you kidding? First of all, Sheldon Leonard in Alibaba and the 40. Wait a minute, I only count 39. out you go, through the door or out the window. I think it's a great idea, but the truth of the matter is Abbott and Costello had been veering that way anyway. Their TV show was kind of like geared towards kids, and they were upset because when it was syndicated, like on the East Coast, it was on at like 10:30 at night. So they lost 90% of their audience, you know, who had to go to bed. But, you know, even the movies, you know, Jack and the Beanstalk, Captain Kidd, the monster movies, these are all geared towards younger audiences. You know, I always tell the story about my father when I asked him early on, I said, you know, Dad, did you go to the Abbott and Costello movies when they opened? And he looked at me like I was crazy. And he said, are you kidding? Those were for kids. By the time they were making movies, I was in my 20s. And I'm like, oh, okay. I guess I'm a moron then, you know, because I still love them. I still think they're hilarious. So anyway, that was an interesting thing for him to say. And this is a man who actually saw the Three Stooges perform with Curly live on stage. And said they weren't funny. They did not have the sound effects. Without the sound effects, they were nothing. There you go. And that's from somebody who was there. Somebody who was there and told me how disappointed he and his friends were watching them. Isn't that a shame? That's really kind of sad. Yeah, with Curly. So, yeah, but they did the same act for like, you know, 50 years. They didn't change a line.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, they had that disease. So I hope we covered all of the mail. All of you who were so nice to write in. We appreciate that. And I think we answered all the questions, eh?
Nicely.
Very nicely, I think. Yeah. Okay. So here's what we're going to do today. We are going to look at some of the people we missed in our last podcast. Now, I'm talking about their relationships, talking about their careers, their trajectories, all of that. And I've got a list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, almost 7 people to talk about, or teams to talk about. Now, I'm wondering, refresh my memory, Jerry, because your memory is much better than mine. Did we discuss Olsen and Johnson in the last podcast?
No, we didn't. And okay, I think the reasoning was that we had, you know, dedicated a whole episode to them. So
yes, we did. Yeah. But a lot of people ask, well, what about Olsen and Johnson? I guess they didn't listen to that episode. It is rather low on the ratings in by the way. So I will reinstate that information. So let's get started. I'm thinking about, and I want to know if you've experienced them, Jerry. Clark and McCullough. Have you watched any of their stuff?
Yes, I have.
What is your educated opinion?
Very much the Bobby Clark show with Paul McCullough standing in the background smiling.
And giggling.
Yes.
Yeah. In that big fur coat.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Yes. And his name was always Blodgett for some reason. Blodgett. I don't know why, but yes, with that huge.
Bobby to remember.
That huge fur coat. And Bobby Clark actually reminded me a lot of Groucho.
Well.
Very similar styles.
In one episode, well, actually, I did a radio show recently, and I covered a lot of this stuff already. But the Clark and McCullough were the only comedy team favorably compared to the Marx Brothers, and I mean the Broadway years. So they were wild; they were just wild. But it was all Bobby Clark. You know, Paul McCullough was with him, but as more of a sidekick, someone to, you know, I want to read a quick quote from Norman Lear. And this is about Harry Ritz, but it applies to Bobby Clark. Norman Lear, when I talked to him, he said, Harry Ritz was as funny as any human being in or out of comedy that I have ever met. He was a jewel in a glorious setting and his brothers were the setting. Isn't that beautiful?
Wow. Yeah. That
describes it beautifully. But Paul McCullough was the setting. He was the spotlight to point to Bobby. And Bobby did all the business. Yeah.
Right. So,
yeah. And it was kind of sad because towards the end, Paul wasn't included at all. He was in like two sketches in their last Broadway show. And Bobby was like an 11. So, yeah. So he was backstage just getting more and more depressed. And I'll tell you what happened as we get to it. But, okay. Paul McCullough was born in 1883 in Springfield, Ohio. Bobby was born 5 years later in 1888, also in Springfield, Ohio. The two of them were boyhood friends. They had practiced in the local gym on the mats doing acrobatics and tumbling and all that stuff. And they became clowns in the circus. And they developed an act. And one of the acts was building a table on top of a table on top of a table on top of a table. And Bobby would get on top. And they would have all this business and dialogue before, of course, the whole thing tumbled down.
Wow.
This led them to burlesque, where they learned all the great routines and did all of those. And then it led to vaudeville, where they did their act. And then eventually Broadway. And Broadway, I mean, they were huge. They were huge on Broadway. They did The Ramblers, which was Burt Calmer and Harry Ruby, the Marx Brothers writers. And that became a Wheeler and Woolsey movie called The Cuckoos in 1930. But the most impressive thing they did was they starred in a Gershwin show, Strike Up the Band. And that was like the cream of the crop. That was, you know, as high as you can get on Broadway.
Yeah.
So at that time, in the late 20s, they made some early talkies at Fox. And some of them were 40 minutes long. Some were 20 minutes long. There's a couple of them on YouTube, by the way. I want you to look for one called Waltzing Around. Waltzing Around. Actually, Paul McCullough has a great part in it for the first time. You're going to see Paul McCullough doing what he was supposed to be doing. So I recommend that one highly. Bobby Clark. Well, let me start with Paul. Then they went to RKO, and they made a series of shorts. They made I think it was six a year for 5 years. So from 1930 to 1935, they made these popular short subjects, and they are crazy. They really are crazy. Bobby Clark is a force of nature. You just can't deny it. He's just uncontrollable. So anyway, Paul McCullough, he's sitting in his dressing room towards the end. He's listening to Bobby get lots of laughs with Fanny Bryce while he's sitting in the dressing room. He gets more and more depressed. He finally checks into a sanitarium in New England, and he stays for a month. He had a nervous breakdown. So when his friend came to get him, once he was ready to be discharged, he asked his friend to pull over at a barbershop so he can get a shave. He's sitting in the barber chair. He grabbed the razor, cut his throat and his wrists, and died 2 days later in the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah. Now you talk about tragic stories. That is, to me, that's the ultimate.
Yeah.
A guy driven out of his own comedy team, getting totally depressed, and then killing himself in the worst possible way. Just horrible. Just horrible. Bobby, of course, you know, he felt terrible. He felt terrible. He didn't know whether to get a new partner, whether he should carry on, blah, blah, blah. He became even bigger as a solo. That's the saddest thing.
Yeah.
He became even more popular. And poor Paul was in the ground somewhere. So Bobby continued working all the way up to his death in 1960. And he starred in many shows. He also starred with Abbott and Costello in Streets of Paris. So it was three great burlesquers all together. I would have loved to have seen that.
Yeah.
That's Clark and McCullough. It's a very sad story. But most of their movies are on YouTube if you're interested. But just get ready. It's all about Bobby Clark. It's all about him. You're going to be,
serious.
If you're not familiar with them, you're going to be a little shocked. Okay. So that was Clark and McCullough. I wanted to mention the Ritz Brothers. Now, I don't know how many of you out there are Ritz Brother fans. I happen to be a huge Ritz Brother fan. I love you too, Jerry. I
yes.
know. Jerry's raising his hand. And he washed it. That's nice. Oh, that's
yeah.
That's an improvement over last time. So, the Ritz Brothers. Let's see. There were three of them. There was actually another brother, George. My brother, George. And a sister also named George. No, I'm kidding. I forget the sister's name. Murray or something. And the three important Ritz Brothers were Al was the oldest. He was born in 1901. Then Jimmy followed 3 years later in 1904. And then Harry, the star of the act, was born in 1907. So they were all separated by 3 years. Harry was the biggest ham of the bunch, so they gave him the center square. He was always in the middle. In fact, Al and Jimmy, there was a joke in Hollywood during those days when the three of them were very popular in the 1930s. They said the definition of a bad agent is someone who represents the Ritz Brothers all but Harry. That was a Hollywood joke. But yeah, and none of the other two were very talented. They just weren't
yes.
fun like Harry, you know?
Yes.
They could sing and dance and they could play straight man to him and stuff. But Harry was the show. Just like Bobby Clark was the show, Harry was pretty much the show. So anyway, Al started as a dancer. He's the one that came up with the name Ritz. He claims he saw it on a truck going by, Ritz Crackers or whatever it was. So he took that name. And then a few years later, Harry and Jimmy decided to join him. And they became a trio. And they became known as a collegiate act, meaning they dressed like college students of the day, meaning their pants, you could have fit 12 people into these pants. They were so big. And they wore straw hats and everything, and they sang and danced like that.
Yeah.
So they made it all the way to the palace. Harry told me they were tops in vaudeville. They made it to the top rung, and of course that led to Broadway again. Harry claims to have introduced the song, the one from Casablanca.
Time goes by. Yeah.
Time goes by. He sang it to a young lady in a Broadway show in 1931.
Wow.
Well, he had a nice voice, Harry. And he sang mm-hmm. it when I saw it. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. So what happens? They're on Broadway and they're doing good work. They find themselves in California where the Educational Company, which is a comedy house, comedy short subjects, hired them for a short called The Hotel Anchovy. It's the only short they ever made. And go figure, Daryl Zanuck, the head of 20th Century Fox, sees it, falls in love with them, and signs them to a contract. So all of a sudden, they're working for 20th Century Fox. They start out by doing spot appearances, specialties, you know? Like
yeah.
their first movie, Sing Baby Sing. You know, they're not part of the plot. They just come in to do their craziness every so often. Every 10 minutes, they'll show up. And that's how they worked for a while, for a few movies. Sonia Henie movies, Alice Faye movies, Don Ameche, you know, all those guys, they supported. Eventually, their roles yeah. started getting bigger. Once they got to a movie called You Can't Have Everything with Alice Faye and Don Ameche, Harry's pretty much the third guy, the third build, basically. And the other two are kind of like Harry's assistants. So Harry got to do almost like a solo, which is what Daryl Zanuck wanted him to do. And Harry refused. He said, if you go solo, I'll make you a big star. You'll be a big star, but you have to get rid of the other two. And he said, no way. I'm not getting rid of the other two. So that's pretty much what did them in.
Wow.
They started making starring movies eventually for Fox, things like Straight Place and Show, Life Begins in College, The Gorilla, Three Musketeers, which is my favorite.
Yeah.
That's a really good movie.
Mm-hmm.
It shows up on the Fox movie channel every so often, and I watch it every time. I just love them. So, okay. So what happens? Al, apparently, this was told to me by the Ritz Brothers biographer, and he hasn't finished the book yet, but he is the biographer. He told me that Al had a drinking problem throughout the years, and I had no idea about this until he told me. And he was the first one to die. He died very young. He was 64. No. Yeah, he was 64 years old. He died in 1965. Right after they finished a show in New Orleans, he walked off stage, had a heart attack, and that was it. He was gone. So the other guys, they took some time off, but eventually they came back as a duo, and they would do their final dance, which they always closed with a spotlight for Al.
Oh,
isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
You had Jimmy, Harry, spotlight. So that was wonderful. Anyway, the two of them worked. Jimmy and Harry worked. They worked at Caesar's Palace for years. My friend Louis Stadlin from Broadway, he was the original Richard Benjamin role on Broadway for the Sunshine Boys. He was in the original. They brought it to Las Vegas. So he was there while the Ritz brothers were working at Caesar's Palace. And now this isn't politically correct, so nobody, I don't want to hear from anyone. This is years ago. But Harry would there was an act. They were like from Argentina. They didn't speak English. Their name was very complicated. So Harry would introduce them. And he'd say, okay, ladies and gentlemen, right now I want to introduce these great acrobats. They're blah, 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 blah. There's they're the three, here they are, the three faggots. And they didn't know what he was saying, and they would come on and do their act. And,
oh,
sorry, but that is, you know, politically incorrect can be very funny.
It can. Yep, it can. Wow.
I know. But this was like, what, the early 60s or whatever? No, wait, the early 70s, actually. But you could still get away with that stuff at the time. So, the two of them worked. They were on the Dick Cavett Show, a memorable Dick Cavett Show, when he was on public television. The two of them had the full half hour. And here's the story. I was supposed to move to Los Angeles in January of 1979. One day I pick up the newspaper and there's an ad for the Beach Theater on Miami Beach. The Ritz Brothers are coming in March for 5 days, and opening for them is Alan Jones from A Night at the Opera, Day at the Races. And I postponed my trip. I stayed an extra 3 months. So I could see the Ritz Brothers. And I went to all five shows. It was actually their last live show, their last live. And I sneaked backstage the very first night I was there. And I'm walking backstage. Now, the secret to sneaking backstage is to look like you belong there. That's all you do. You know, look busy, whatever.
Yep.
But I walked backstage. I looked up, and there was my hero, Harry Ritz, in his tuxedo, walking towards his dressing room. And I yelled, "Mr. Ritz!" And he stopped. He turned around. My heart was pounding. You have to understand, I was like 19. And he walked up and he said, "Yes." And I said, "Hi, my name is Nick Santamaria." Now, I had just written him a amazing fan letter, you know, just praising him to high heaven. And I said, "My name is Nick Santamaria." He went, "What?" I said, "Nick Santamaria." He grabbed me by my lapels and pulled me into the dressing room and said, "Jimmy, this is the kid I was telling you about." Guys, you have to understand, I love the Ritz Brothers. He knew me. Harry Ritz knew me. And then we posed for pictures out the wazoo. He put me in the middle. Harry put me in the middle. I saw all five shows, and it was just wonderful. I even met Alan Jones, who looked very depressed, sitting at his card table signing cassettes of his music, you know, for people. and not many people bought them. So, but anyway, later on, I got to work with his son, Jack, at a benefit that I hosted. But anyway, that was the Ritz brothers. I got to see them. I got to meet them. Harry and I would write letters. I ran into him every so often in Los Angeles. And it's just wonderful to be known by someone you idolize, you know? So that was that. And Jimmy died in 1985, was it? Yeah, 1985, at the age of 81. And Harry, this was sad. Harry passed away the following year. They didn't tell him about Jimmy dying because he was kind of frail at that point. And they thought he had Alzheimer's towards the end, like the last few months of his life. But it wasn't. His wife, Naomi, told me that he was misdiagnosed. The doctor gave him medication that made him crazy.
Ooh.
Harry Ritzy. Like he needs to be made crazy. But you know what I'm saying? He was on the wrong medication and he died. He was, I don't think he was 80. He was like 79 or whatever. Yeah. Anyway, that's sad. Harry deserved better than that. He made a lot of people happy. So that's the Ritz brothers, and they got along like nobody's business. They were as close as brothers can be. There was no controversy there, no split ups, no arguments. You know, I'm sure Al's drinking was a bit of a problem, but we didn't know anything about it. You know,
yeah.
They kept close to the vest. And that's the Ritz brothers. Okay, now I just wanted to mention quickly, I know we covered Olsen and Johnson in a complete episode when we talked about Hell's a Poppin'. I was telling Jerry that that's one of our lowest ratings on YouTube. I think it's 400 something. After 6 months or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But anyway, it wasn't a real popular one. But so since a lot of people probably didn't hear it, I just want to tell you an interesting story about Olsen and Johnson. They were a team from the 1910s. They were musicians together in a band. They broke away from the band. They became a comedy team. They started Hell's a Poppin' on Broadway, 1,400 performances. They did other shows on Broadway. They made movies. They were very popular. Their live shows mostly were popular. They also got into television as well. So anyway, very popular, Olsen and Johnson, Ole Olsen and Chick Johnson. So Chick Johnson, they both moved to Las Vegas in their final years. Chick Johnson passes away. He dies in 1961, I think it was. And they bury him in a cemetery in Las Vegas. And they buried him. They wanted to be buried next to each other. Okay. So they put the first one to die on the left side, right? On the right side, they were waiting for Ole, you know, when he was going to pass away. And it didn't take long. He passed away the following year. But when they saw the setup, I see you smiling, Jerry. When they saw the setup, it couldn't be Johnson and Olsen.
No.
Exhumed Chick. And it's just no Olsen and Johnson. And they put him in the right one, on the right side. And they put Ole on the left. So they were Olsen and Johnson for the rest of their death. I was going to say the rest of their lives, but no, you can't.
Yeah.
So that's the story. I just think that's a fascinating story. And I actually saw it.
Yeah.
So that was Olsen and Johnson. Next, I wanted to talk about... Now, first of all, I need to know, did we discuss Brown and Carney?
Yeah, that was part of the... they want their own Bud and Lou. Yeah.
Right, during that thing. But I'm talking about this topic now. How did they get along and, you know, all that stuff. I'll do it quickly because there's not a lot to talk about. They worked together for 3 years, basically, 43 to 46. You know, they made a few movies. So it was not that big a deal. It didn't really matter how they got along because they were both under separate contracts. They were both, you know, they both knew that they were cockamamie Abbott and Costello imitators. So, you know, so that was that. But again, like most comedy teams, Wally Brown was older. He was born in 1904. in New England, because you hear it in his voice. Every line he says sounds like he's from, well, yeah. Let the Russians go to Mars. So we have Brown, 1904 to 1961. He only lived to be 57. That's too young to die. I want a recount. And then Carney, Alan Carney, was born in 1909, 5 years after. So he was the younger person, and he lived longer. He lived in 1973, but he was only 63 when he died. So these guys, I think the lesson here is never imitate Abbott and Costello, because you'll die young. Okay, so that was Brown and Carney. I did Who's on First one, and I died the next day. Okay, now here's one I wanted to talk about. And I know somebody suggested this. I forget who, if it was Janet or whatever. We just did the emails. She mentioned the Three Stooges, you know? And Lou, sometimes people, the Lou haters, let's put it this way, and there are some out there, they like to point to Curly and say, oh, look, Lou stole from Curly. Oh, look, Lou stole from Curly. I got news for you, folks. When Lou Costello got into burlesque in the late 20s, when he was 23, around there, it took only a year or two before critics were calling him a unique comic personality. He was developing his own style, and he had every opportunity to do it. Whereas Curly was stepping into something that already existed, you know, and I'm sure the shtick he brought to the act really is what was most popular about the act even then, you know. But even today, it's all about Curly. They love Curly.
Yeah.
So I don't see the similarities. I don't see them at all. Lou is a very developed character who is able to fall in love with a woman, who's able to, you know, take on a job without destroying the house. You know what I mean? He was a cartoon character. So were all the Stooges. And that's why I can't put them on the same level as most of the others. W.C. Fields was a great actor. Lou Costello was a great actor.
Yes.
Bud was a great actor. So, you know what I mean? Curly, you don't believe it. He's a cartoon character that goes in, he makes noises, he falls down, he spins around. You know, he's great for what he is, you know?
Yeah.
But compare him to Lou Costello. He's not even close, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, the Three Stooges. Shemp, in the early days, was afraid of Ted Healy. Ted Healy was a loose cannon, the guy who created the Three Stooges. He was a loose cannon when he got drunk. You didn't know what he was going to do. He set a lot of people's homes on fire, by the way. He loved setting things on fire. You could be sitting talking to him and you'll smell smoke, you know, and he had just come from the other room. The other room will be on fire.
Oh!
Yeah, that was Ted Healy. You didn't get him drunk. You don't get Ted Healy drunk. Mm. But anyway, Shemp was afraid of him, and Shemp eventually went off on his own. And then Curly took over, you know, the younger brother. And eventually they broke away from Healy and they became what we know them as, the Three Stooges, making those wonderful shorts at Columbia. But what I'm getting at is there's a new book about Shemp. And I mean, it's about a year old now. I'm in it quite a bit. There, I was quoted. But the thing is, Curly was a problem. Curly was a party boy. He was a guy who drank too much, smoked too much. There were too many wives. He loved to dance. He loved to get up with the orchestra and play the bass. I mean, he was Joe Party Boy. And it's amazing that he was able to do what he did in the shorts during the day and in the mornings, you know.
Yep.
Larry was also, he was a gambler. You know, he more than likely was at the track, you know, the day before. Curly was at every nightclub that was open, you know, at the time. And Mo, of course, was the straight arrow. He was Mr. Family Man and, you know, whatever. But this book highlights the fact that Mo, in his autobiography, took credit for everything that Shemp did. And I mean discovering Larry. Mo describes how he was there and they saw Larry and this. Mo wasn't even in the act at that point. He was doing real estate with his mother. Yet he claimed that he was there and blah, blah, blah. All these things that Shemp did, Mo took credit for. And it's fascinating to see. It's like, why would he do that to his brother, his older brother, who couldn't be there to, you know, contradict him? He was already dead. So, and that was another point.
Yeah.
You know, it's like everybody around Mo died of a stroke. You know, they say that Shemp died of a heart attack. No, he didn't. He died of a embolism. Yeah. So all Larry, Curly, Shemp, all three of them died of the same thing. Now, all three of them were victims of Mo's abuse. And I mean, my dad told me you heard every slap from the stage. It was real. So these guys, they had a career of getting their heads battered. Like football players today,
you know,
they get that disease. I'm sorry, but that I firmly believe that that's what caused their deaths. I'm sure this is going to be controversial. I'm sure I'm going to hear from people, but I really don't care. It makes perfect sense that when you spend 20 years getting hit on the head, you know, or slapped in the face, there's going to be repercussions and concussions. But anyway, that's my my thing about the Stooges. I don't think they were on the same level as Abbott and Costello. Abbott and Costello were able to do things that real people did, you know, whereas the Stooges, it's kind of like, oh, look, another. Anyway, that's going to be hugely unpopular because the Stooges are so popular. Okay, so now we have a very special one. Actually, I have two that you're going to be surprised by. One is Mitchell and Petrillo. Duke Mitchell and Sammy Petrillo.
Dookie!
We are talking about the Martin and Lewis imitators that got together for, I guess, about 5 years. Their career lasted. They got together to do club dates, and they actually had quite a few and good ones. And they made one movie called Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla, which I think is funnier than any Martin and Lewis movie. Sammy Petrillo looked exactly like young Jerry Lewis. Skinny, the hair, the face, everything. And he was hired first by, I think it was Milton Berle, to play Baby Jerry. So, you know, Berle opened up the pram, the stroller, and there was Sammy dressed as a baby as Jerry. So it was a big sight gag. Everybody loved it. Eddie Cantor used him for the same kind of purpose. And then eventually Jerry hired him to do the same thing, to be the young son, whatever. But he had no dialogue. You know, it was just a sight gag. Well, it turns out that Jerry destroyed them. Dean was like, let them make a living. It doesn't hurt us at all. Let them make a living. If anything, it's advertising for us, you know, for the real thing. Jerry would not have it. He sued them. He drove them out of business, basically. Club owners were afraid to book them because Lewis said, we will never play your venue if you book them. It's very, very Trump-like in a way. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean that. It's very Trumpet-like, like the instrument. Like that. I think I got away with that. Either way, it blows. But you know, it's these crazy kids today. But so what happened was the two of them were driven out of business. They went their separate ways. Sammy, you know, showed up in exploitation films and nudie cutie films is what they called them at the time. They were very innocent, but there was female nudity in them. Keyholes Are for Peeping, I think he was in that. You know, kind of salacious stuff. He never really made any mainstream headway or anything. And he died fairly recently, probably within the last 10 years or so. And there's a brand new book coming out about him. that Drew Friedman is pushing like crazy. He says, we can now rest. The universe can now rest. We have the book about Sammy Petrillo. And here's the sad part of the story. There's always a sad part of the story. I moved to Los Angeles, and like I said, in 1979. And that same year, I lived in Studio City. And no, this was 1980. And I'm driving by a very famous place called the Sportsman's Lodge, which was right across the street from where I lived. And there was a marquee. And on the marquee, it said, benefit tonight for Duke Mitchell. So Duke, he died broke. He died very shortly afterwards. He was completely broke. He had written, directed, starred in, and produced two mafioso films. I have both of them, and they're hilarious. Mm. One of them is about killing the Pope. I think it's called Pope Goes the Weasel. I'm not sure, but it is all about killing the Pope. And I'll tell you, Duke's movies, they're really something. They are really something. Here's the interesting part about it. He takes time in both films to do a monologue about how Italians are perceived, you know, as violent and mafioso and this and that. I can't believe they believe this. And then the next scene is him shooting a priest in the head. You know, it's like, what are you preaching here, Duke? Oh, God. Anyway, so Dukey ended up that way. Sammy, you know, died of natural causes recently. And that was Mitchell and Petrillo.
Wow.
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot there. And speaking of which, I added this today. I just wrote it down. I jotted it down just for fun. But Keaton and Durante. How about that? They were an official comedy team for about a minute. Keaton, that's true. Keaton was at wit's end. He was already a hopeless alcoholic at this point. His movie career was dead. But actually, the sound movies he made at MGM made more money than any of his silent films, made more money than The General, than Sherlock Jr., than all the classic Keaton movies. And that just totally depressed the hell out of him. And he just drank more, you know. And during that time, MGM, in their infinite comedy wisdom, decided that Keaton needed help. So what did they do? They went to the most talkative comedian you could possibly imagine. Now, I'm a huge Durante fan. I'm looking at right now. I've got the sheet music for Inka Dinka Doo up there. I've got my own puppet of Umbriago from the Colgate Comedy Hour. I have a button of Durante and Umbriago. I'm a huge Durante fan. But in these movies, they gave him all the obnoxious stuff. They gave him all the dialogue. He's 10 times bigger than he should be. Poor Keaton is drunk usually and is being is kind of like not doing anything. You know what I mean? It's sad. It's really sad. Yeah. You take one of the great comic minds of the century and MGM didn't know what to do with him. But it was also Keaton's fault. Keaton did not handle the tragedy in his life at that time. He went to alcohol, just like his dad did, and disappointed everybody. Ended up in a straitjacket, by the way. And Durante, you know, he stayed at MGM as long as he could, and they got rid of him. They dumped him. And then he became like a free agent, and he did other films at other studios. But it wasn't until MGM rehired him in the early 40s that we got to know the Jimmy Durante we all love. And that was, he wasn't always like screaming and yelling and running around and doing all the stuff he did in the Buster Keaton movies. He was calm. He was charming. He sang wonderful songs, you know? Mm-hmm. And then he got on television and he was even better on television. And I grew up watching, you know, he was an old man and we loved him. We just loved him. Kids, right? He would show up. I'll never forget the last thing he ever did I watched. And it was the Sonny and Cher show. He was the guest. And I knew he was finished because as the other people were saying their lines, he was moving his lips. sang their lines with them.
Right?
It's a real old person thing to do. And that's when I knew it was time for him to retire. Unfortunately, he had a stroke and he was forced into retirement. And I went to his funeral and the burial. And let me just tell you very quickly, the funeral was amazing because Desi Arnaz arranged it. There was Desi Arnaz standing right next to me. Every comedian in show business was there. I sat between Fritz Feld and Iron Eyes Cody. And I wish I knew at the time that he was really Sicilian, because I am too. We could have talked about it. But it was an incredible thing. Bob Hope and Danny Thomas did the eulogies. That'll give you an idea of the star power. It was packed. Even Marlon Brando showed up. That's how much people loved Jimmy. Yeah. The next day at the burial at the Holy Cross Cemetery, this is my favorite part. As the coffin was being lowered into the ground, his partner at the time, Sonny King, the guy who introduced Martin to Lewis, Sonny King yells out, "One more hand for the schnoz." And we all broke into applause as the casket was going down. I'm getting all choked up now thinking about it. It was really a beautiful, beautiful moment. So I really think that's all I've got prepared for this episode of the Abbott and Costello Beat the Podcast. I did want to show Jerry a gift I got from my friend Dan Young, who I had breakfast with this morning. He went out of his way during his travels, and it was very, very kind, of him. But he got this at a yard sale. But it's Lou for mayor. Lou Costello, I'm a bad boy for mayor. And Bud Abbott for the Laugh Commissioner. And this is what we hand out at the 1939 World's Fair. This was 1940 now. They were doing a version of Streets of Paris at the World's Fair. And they would hand out these buttons. So I have one now. There it is.
Wow.
Isn't that beautiful? Thank
That's
you.
That's fantastic.
Dan Young, I'm going to treasure this, really, at least until tomorrow. You know what, Jerry? A lot of the people tell me when I get emails from people and I get comments, they love the fact that you're doing more talking during the podcast. And seriously, I want to encourage that. This one wasn't so much. Let's face it, I had a lot to say in this one. I'm sorry, everyone. But Jerry, I want to throw the ball to you at this point. And if you have any thoughts about what was going on during this episode, I would love to hear them now.
Okay. Well, first and foremost,
perfect.
Okay. You are.
I feel. Oh. I couldn't wait to do that. All right.
Okay. First and foremost, you are by far the expert in these areas. I've got knowledge in some of these areas, but you, my friend, with your college level teachings and book writing and stuff like that, you are definitely the guy here. And I'm second of all, I'm just thrilled and delighted to be a part of this. But yes, I appreciate everything you say. I learn a lot in this as well. Going quickly back over some of the things we've talked about in this episode, the only thing that pops into my head, the very first time I ever did an impression of someone on stage, it was in my sophomore year of high school. We did a variety show. It was like a 1930s speakeasy was the theme of the evening. And I opened the show doing Jimmy Durante singing one of those songs.
Oh, I love that. Well, first of all, it's a great song.
Yes.
We grew up with it listening, like on WABC on the radio. All of a sudden, Jimmy Durante is singing one of those songs.
Yep.
Don't you hear now and then? And it was rousing. It was great.
Yep.
And what a great late in the day song. It was a hit song. But yeah. That's something. I think that one of the best jobs I ever had, and my friend Lewis Wilkenfeld, I don't know if he listens to this podcast or not. If you listen, Lewis, I love you, and you're my favorite director, one of them. One of the top three, let me put it that way. But anyway, he hired me to do Girl Crazy, which was a 1930 show. We're not talking about the Wheeler and Woolsey version in 1932 or the Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland thing in the 1940s. We're talking about the original script for Broadway. All the politically incorrect stuff, all the original orchestrations. It was as pure as you could get. He hired me to do the comedy lead, which was played by a guy by the name of Willie Howard, one of the biggest comedians on Broadway. Entirely forgotten today. Although you could see him on YouTube. You could put Willie Howard in. You'll get a bunch of his short subjects and stuff. But anyway, Willie Howard was a very funny guy. Jewish, and he spoke with the Jewish dialect usually. But he was also an impressionist. He did incredible spot-on imitations. In Girl Crazy, he got to sing, "They're writing songs of love, but not for me." He got to sing that to the leading lady, who's very depressed, and he's trying to cheer her up. So he does four different imitations. And he did people from that day who wouldn't have read today. It wouldn't have been good. So I chose four people that the audience would recognize, but were from that era. So I got to sing, "They're writing songs of love, but not for me," as Burt Lahr, Maurice Chevalier, Al Jolson, and then I closed with Durante and walked off the way he scrubs. I never heard such applause in my life, Jerry. It was a life-changing moment. It was just amazing.
Wow.
So, yeah. Four of the greatest entertainers of all time I got to do as part of this show. What a great show it was, too. Lewis, if you're listening, thank you. So that's that. And look up Willie Howard. We're going to talk about him on future episodes. Jerry and I were talking before we went on the air. That sounds like something you do at the dentist. You know, you go on the air. I think, anyway. We were talking about where this podcast is going to go. We're getting to the end of, you know, what more can you say about Abbott and Costello? I think we've covered every movie. We've covered the television show. We've talked about the radio show. The reason we don't do a full episode about the radio show is because it's very difficult to find the things I want to pinpoint. You know, it would take like forever, really. But there's plenty to choose from. They're all out there. You could listen to them. They're on YouTube. They're on the Internet Archive, .org. And they're all there. Okay. So we're going to start doing episodes about other comedians, maybe about Universal horror movies, maybe, you know, we'll do the Ritz Brothers Universal movies. I just want to know what you think, you guys out there in listening land. Would it be okay if we veered away a little bit from Abbott and Costello and started opening it up to talk about other people and other things? Let us know. Write to me and let us know. You could leave it on YouTube, on comments, or even if you have my email address, nsm555@msn.com. nsm555@msn.com. So let us know what you think. And if you have any ideas or anyone you want to know about, anyone you want us to expound on, anyone you want us to ignore, anyone you want us to assassinate, anyone you want us to lather with orange jelly and pushed over the side of the Atlantic City Pier. Anyone? Okay, I'll stop there. I got a little silly. I got a little silly, you know. Even talk about Ed Wynn, you know. So anyway, we're going to be looking into that. So that should be exciting. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope you learned as much as Jerry did. I'm just repeating what you said. And as usual, it was an absolute pleasure and something I look forward to a lot. And Jerry, thank you so much. I really wish we lived closer because I have a feeling we would be really, really good buds.
You know,
I mean, not good buds, but you know what I'm saying.
I do. Especially after our previous episode where we were actually sitting right next to each other when we recorded it. That was a marvelous experience, but it was also a horrible experience because now I know what it's like to have that marvelous experience and I want it all the time.
You know what? I thought about coming back to do this episode.
Mm.
But it turns out that my other buddy, Dan, wanted to get together on this day. And so I had to choose. And, you know, Dan was great. He was just great. And you were just great. Last episode, I mean, I would do it all the time if I could. And who knows, when I move to Oregon eventually, I'll be closer. And we could we could do as much as you want. But anyway, thank you, Jerry. As usual, you're just a pleasure.
Thank you.
And ladies and gentlemen, fans of the podcast, thank you for being loyal. Thank you for all your nice words. It's all been positive, and I can't thank you enough for that. People are really enjoying what we do, Jerry, and I feel good putting it out there.
Yes.
You know? So let's continue, and we will see you on the next episode, which might be about, you know, Wheeler and Woolsey. I don't know. We'll see. But in the meantime, everybody, take good care of yourself. And we'll see you soon, you know.